Welcome to the Out of Chicago podcast. I'm your host, Chris Smith, and this is the show where we introduce you to the world's most inspiring photographers and help you to live your best creative life. So today we're here with flower photographer Jackie Kramer. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you, Chris. It's exciting to be here with you.
Yeah, you're going to be one of our instructors at our Out of Longwood conference at Longwood Gardens outside of Philadelphia, and we're super excited to do this. And I'm hanging out with you now, and we've talked a lot, and we've figured this all out, but we've never actually met in person, so I'm really excited to have you as one of our instructors, so it's going to be great.
Yes, so, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So let's talk first. You do lots of your own workshops. You actually just got finished with your own, I don't know, do you call it a conference? What do you call it? Tell us about what you just finished up this last weekend.
Yes, I had a workshop that was called Florographers Unite 2019. It was held in Asheville, North Carolina. And it's an outgrowth of a group that I have on Facebook with over 5,600 people. And a few years ago, I started holding conferences so that some of them could meet each other and work together to further grow their floral photography.
And I think I always spell it wrong. So can you, if people that are trying to find the group on Facebook, how do you spell this Florographers? Or what's the actual name of the Facebook group?
The name of the Facebook group is Florography - Artistic Floral Photography. And Florography is spelled Florography.
All right, perfect.
I had to extend that and add the hyphen because somebody already used the word florography out there.
Oh, geez. Why would they do that to you, Jackie?
I know.
You're the florographer. Come on, get out of here. And are you from Florida? Is that right?
I am.
Yeah, you live in Florida, and so you came up and you did the thing in Asheville. That's somewhere I've always wanted to go. Why did you pick that? Is that where you always go for this Florographers Unite, or do you go to different locations?
We move it around every year. The first year we held it in Gainesville, Florida, and then the second year it was in Denver. We usually, I co-locate it near or at a botanical garden or an arboretum. And then this one was held in Asheville. I try to move it around so it's more accessible to a group of people in a certain region within Florography Online. So I don't know where next year's will be.
And do you have other instructors there, or is it mostly you and the other people? How does that work?
Yes, almost all of our instructors come from my group, from Florography. So there were 7 other instructors. One of whom was not an official member of Florography, but we were very fortunate to bring in a Canon expert who was able to teach some ancillary sessions on how to navigate your way around the Canon camera body. He also did some face headshots for people, as well as taught some classes on how to select and prepare your images for competition. And that was Michael Joseph.
So tell us everything. Tell us the instructors you had and tell us what they taught.
Okay. Well, I had a variety of florographers there who have developed some skills in various areas, starting with Eileen Sklon, who did intentional camera movement. She taught everybody how to do in-camera abstracts, blurs, zooms, and create some beautiful abstracts. Valerie Interligi did some reflections with mylar and plexiglass. She had setups with flowers and light tents. One thing that she did, especially for this, was to develop a technique where she does painting and uses those as backgrounds, which then reflect in the surfaces. And then we had Carol Rasmussen with lens babies that were loaned to us by Lens Baby. She took people out. Everybody went out in small groups of 10 or less, and she was able to then help people put those on their bodies with the mount specifically for their bodies so they could test out some of the lens babies. Some people already had them, but hadn't really had anyone guide them through their use. Then we had Marion Brasella, who was able to go out into the garden and really help people approach flowers and look for good, suitable, complementary backgrounds. And Padma Ingava had a few light boxes there that she and her spouse had built, or partner. And so she helped show people how to arrange the flowers for appealing compositions and then shoot them on the light boxes. And then we had Paul Johnson share with us his dispersion technique for creating spatter from a flower. So we did a combination of both shooting at stations indoors and outdoors. And then we spent a full day and two thirds on editing.
Fantastic. And then are there gardens there as well that you're going to?
So we were housed at the Arboretum. So all we had to do to shoot was just walk outside, which was
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. So it's an arboretum. It sounds like trees to me, but I'm assuming there are lots of flowers.
Well, interestingly, in Asheville, the botanical garden is more like an arboretum, and the arboretum is more like a botanical garden.
Oh, okay.
And, it's a little bit opposite of what one would assume. But I try to select locations that have a good classroom setting, which are easy to access from an airport or driving, and are close to a hotel. And in this case, the auditorium was really probably the most ideal classroom setting that I've ever been in. So it was nice. We had that for four full days. And then we had our lunch catered. So people really didn't have to leave. I would say that our Denver workshop last year had a profusion of flowers, just an extraordinary kaleidoscope of flowers. So as far as botanical gardens go, that one was better. But what we really try to do is teach people various techniques. And I also did light painting and light pads, which I didn't mention earlier. So we do this at the beginning of the summer so that people can apply the techniques that they learned throughout the summer then when they go back home or travel.
Fantastic. Sounds very similar to what we do for our out of Chicago, out of Longwood garden conferences. And we're super excited to have you as one of our instructors this year in August. Can you tell us what you'll be teaching at the Out of Longwood event?
Yeah, so we'll be doing excursions. And when I take people out, we'll be focusing on how to vary your depth of field, how to look for specific flowers and how to approach them, looking at lighting and vantage points. And most importantly, we'll be looking at backgrounds. So if somebody is more advanced, they might choose to work on shooting textures or doing multiples or abstracts. So it'll really vary depending on their level of experience and what they bring to the workshop in terms of their photographic experience, as well as where they want to go with it.
That's right. And you're going to give a presentation or two as well?
Yes, I'm going to be doing a presentation on editing, and I'll show some of my editing techniques. Then I'll also be doing a demonstration with light painting against a black, a more dramatic setup.
Very cool. And is that something that people get to try then as well at the event? Are we going to be able to set that up?
Yes, we'll have that set up, and I'll leave the station set up as long as it's logistically possible so that once I do the demo, I can walk away and people then can go ahead and work with it on their own.
Yeah, and that's kind of the best part about what we're talking about here is whether it's yours or ours, it's, people get a chance to learn something new, and then they get the chance to try it. And then they get feedback on what they did because they're doing it. To try these things at home is really fun, but to be able to do it and be able to show the back of your camera to, the pros and they go, oh yeah, that's perfect. But try this. You go, oh, I never even thought about that. So to get that immediate feedback is really, to me, what makes these events so special. And you can learn absolutely. So quickly. Yeah.
I agree with that because even some of my other presenters do things. And when I see them online, they're beautiful, but I have no idea how they're really doing them. And when we're there in person and you have that visual, you can have those aha moments that you can then employ on your own.
That's exactly right. And I feel that you could do the same thing, by learning a lot of things online, but, it's just the time frame that it takes is really spread out. So when you come to one of these events, you're really immersing yourself in photography that entire time and you're getting that immediate feedback, which makes it so you can just, oh yeah, well, let me try that right now with the setup right in front of me. So, I don't know. That's what makes these things really kind of special.
Well, there's really no substitution for that personal connection also, which you really can't get in the same manner online. So when I work with someone who's teaching me or vice versa, I will always remember that experience. And when I have an experience, it's a more visceral takeaway for me. And I hope for my students who will remember they'll have that muscle memory of doing it and doing it with me. So yeah, I think there's no substitution for that.
Yeah. I mean, a big part of it is just about the experience. Totally agree. So you are really known for your creativity and the way that you're able to, you know, make images that look different than other people and to come up with new things. So what are some of the secrets behind your creativity, and what can other people do and apply that to their own work?
Okay, well, I don't think that I have any secrets because I share everything that I do.
I'm telling everyone their secrets. Okay, tell them now. Go.
Okay. Well, one thing that I do pride myself on is I do everything myself. And that's not to take away from people who purchase textures or use certain software, but I really like to say that everything that went into my image was done by me. So if there's a texture, I've shot it. If there's something that's been done, either a gradient applied or some kind of a layer applied, I've made all the decisions in Lightroom and Photoshop. So it's just a matter of choice. It's like, I use food a lot for my analogies, but if I'm going to cook a dinner, I want to cook the whole thing. I don't want to make the turkey and then go buy a can of cranberry sauce. I want to get my cranberries and I want to make my own cranberry sauce. And so I kind of feel it's the same way. If I'm going to serve you Thanksgiving dinner, I'm probably not going to just serve you a turkey with all these pre-purchased accoutrements. I want to make all the, you know, the sweet potatoes and all that. So the textures are the same way. If I go to a garden or I go somewhere and I travel and I'm shooting, I want to do it all. I don't want to just come home with the meat. I want the potatoes too.
All right. So for some people, you're going to have to back up and explain what you mean by the textures. Because like in your group, tons of people do this work in the Florographers group, but a lot of people don't know what you're talking about when you say that you're shooting your own textures. So can you explain that?
Yes, I absolutely can. So, and it's not something that everybody likes. It's a matter of taste. But if you do apply any kind of either grunge or something that's going to add to or enhance your image. So, for example, let's say you have a flower and you want to put some striations or waves or something in the background. If you've got a nice clean background and maybe even foreground, what can you do? There's a lot of beautiful textures that are out there, or you can create them on your own. And it could be as simple as a photograph of the rock or some coral or statues. It could be close-ups. They could be color washes and blurs, or they could be rough surfaces. So it's just different things that you can lay over your image and mask in. And you can do multiple textures, one texture or no textures. But I always try to shoot them wherever I go, whenever I'm out, so that I'm always able to easily access them, and they kind of come from the same area or the same garden. So I don't really keep a library of textures. I'm constantly always cooking them up, just like my turkey dinner.
So what you're describing, make sure I have this right, is that you'll take a photograph of a flower, but while you're in the same garden or, you know, during the same day, you'll also look for some things like, I don't know, might be the brick wall up close with interesting texture, or it might be, I don't, like you said, a rock, or it might be another flower up close, I'm guessing. I don't know. But then in Photoshop, you combine the two together. So rather than having, I think in most cases, it kind of is to get rid of a distracting background, or am I wrong about that?
Well, I'll give you an example. I love shoot-throughs, and so some of the images I have are shot where you have a foreground that comes very close to and almost touching your lens, and then you might also have a nice background. And if you're shooting with a very wide aperture, your depth of field is very, very small, and so you may get a flower that peeks through the foreground and the background. And so I like that. It's very beautiful. You have a very misty, ethereal look, but with a flower that's clear somewhere in there. And so I recently had an image like that. And then I applied a texture, which was a brain coral. It was just a slab of coral embedded in the walkway at the location where I shot this. So that then was overlaid on this nice clean green foreground and background, and then I brushed it in ever so slightly, so you may not even know that it's there, but you can definitely tell when you look at it with and without. So it just gives you a little bit more depth and richness to the image, and I like to kind of say that it that comes from the same location, giving it the same DNA.
The same DNA. I like that. Nice. So you'll take that image of the coral or whatever, you'll take the image of the flower, and there'll be different layers in Photoshop. And you just, like you said, layer mask and kind of brush in just where you want that texture to be. Am I saying that right? Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. So now the answer to this better be yes, by the way, Jackie, are you going to be showing people how to do this at Longwood?
Oh, absolutely. That's the subject of my editing session.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And are people going to have a chance when they're out shooting with you to be like, hey, now's the time to find the textures?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So people get to learn the technique, go out in the field and try it. And then we're going to have lots of image review sessions and one-on-one time for people to work with all the different instructors and say, yeah, this looks great, but try it like this or whatever it is. So we'll make sure there's an opportunity for people to go to an image review session so that you can say, yeah, that's exactly right. Or try doing it a little different.
You may want to apply to somebody else's technique that one of the other instructors is showing them. And so they'll have that in their catalog.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. So I kind of assume that other photographers will keep a folder on their hard drive of all these different textures. Is that right? And that's kind of what makes you different a little bit, is that you're like, wait, I'm not just going back to my pictures from 2012 or whatever. Like you said, I'm capturing them in the same area with the same DNA. Am I saying that right?
Yes, absolutely. And then sometimes if I'm shooting indoors, I've got... I don't really have access to the same things I might have if I was outside in a garden, but I have access to all kinds of things in my home. And so sometimes I may have a texture on my same external drive that will lend itself very nicely to a specific image. So it's not an always one way or another way, but you're absolutely right. I don't have a library or a special place which contains all of my textures. I'm always developing and shooting more.
Mm-hmm. What a cool challenge, though. I mean, to say, I'm going to do this, you know, for anyone, even if you're not really into the textures, to give it a shot and to say, I'm going to try this and I'm going to go out and shoot for the textures themselves and put it all together. And yeah, I think, I don't know, it kind of intrigues me. I want to go give it a shot. So I'm excited to learn from you as well. That's like the best part about my job, is I get to learn from the best. So I'm excited about that. So, you know, another type of project you've talked about, and you do this in your Facebook group, is you give people like a weekly theme or a challenge or an assignment. Can you tell us what you do for those?
Yes. Yeah, so that is actually one of our most recent challenges or themes was textures. And it's interesting because we've got so many people now that have come in because they love floral photography, but they all come from a different place. And some have never used or even seen the application of textures. And when they join the group, it's kind of a little bit of a shock because so many people do use them. And it's absolutely not a necessity because we do so many different things. But when they see it, they sometimes are a little bit reluctant to embrace it. But now that I've run the theme, people have gone out and said, oh, I think I might try it. And so it's wonderful to watch people kind of figure it out on their own and grow because we're not able to be doing workshops where everybody lives. So we inspire each other. So I've done other themes. Some of them are color combos. So show us some color combinations that you've shot, shoot throughs, tech tips, where we'll talk about things like single point focus. How do you, you know, get to know your camera better and compose in camera to the greatest extent possible so you're not cropping out pixels later. Another theme was one word, share an image of a floral image, and then assign it a word. So it might have a personality, it might be perky, it might be contemplative, it might be pesky, if it's got thorns on it, it could be all kinds of different things. A lot of them make people laugh. Then we had another theme, other photographers. So who is another photographer that is a great, a luminary that may not even be alive still and may not even do floral photography, but who has influenced you and why? And I think that's perhaps one of the most important things is the ability of an artist, be they photographers or painters or poets or musicians, to really recognize and learn from others and understand what resonates with you from them. And maybe even if it doesn't resonate with you, what does their work bring and how does it inform the conversation of the art and of that field? Because I think that we as the makers are better the more we know about what goes on out there. And even if we don't share in the same philosophies or styles, I think that it helps to sharpen our skill set and make us a better human the more that we know and understand other artists.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of people believe that creativity means you're doing something completely 100% original. And I don't think that's, it's almost never the case. And the idea is you got to take these other people's ideas and how do you twist it into something different? And I'm thinking, I love your idea of the shoot throughs and I love your idea of using the textures. And I shoot a lot of architecture downtown Chicago. I'm like, how could I do something really interesting with that, with like the L tracks? And then I could get some great textures of the rust and the grit down on the L,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And combine that together. And people will go, wow, Chris, how'd you come up with this 100% original idea? I'd be like, well, you know, I just stole from Jackie, but apply it in a slightly different way, right? And that's kind of, go ahead.
Absolutely. I think that no one is 100% self-taught. We may not have gone to school and studied in a formal sense, but we've all looked at images online or read books or gone to museums. And just the mere fact that we have taken it in and had a visual reaction and an experience to another person's art of any form informs who we are and it helps shape our work. So I think that the credit goes to, you know, every other artist out there, and also not even all artists, but, you know, people that have helped drive us in certain ways, you know, sort of maybe even given us a theme or a challenge or introduced us to a concept through a workshop such as Out of Longwood that I may not have known about certain people's styles if I wasn't there. You know, I may not have known about some of your other presenters had you not have selected them, and you chose them all for very specific reasons for what they do. And so I think our minds have to be open and our hearts have to be open to receive all of this and not to copy them, but to be informed and be shaped by what they do and then apply it as you see fit, just like you just described with the application of shoot-throughs to downtown Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool. I mean, that's one really neat thing about having all these different photographers in one place, all the ones that you described and like all the people that we'll have out of Longwood, whether it's John Barclay, Alan Shapiro, Ann Belmont, or you, everyone looks at photography in a slightly different way. And even if you're all photographing flowers, it's amazing how many different perspectives you can get. There's people in our Facebook group, someone put on their thing, they said, lens babies, you got to be kidding me. That's the exact opposite of what I'm trying to do, because he's shooting all focus stacked. You know, he's trying to get as much detail through the entire flower as he can. And it is, it's like the exact opposite of that. And then there's people that are like, textures, you got to be kidding me. I was going to actually do photography. Like, oh, I shouldn't have said that on our interview. I'm so sorry. But do you see what I'm saying? Like, some people believe like the textures, like to be creative in the image and in Photoshop is the best way to present their creative vision. And other people are like, well, if I didn't just take the straight picture, then it's not actually photography. I shouldn't have said that. I feel like terrible now that I even said it and you're here. But do you see what I'm saying? It's like people have different perspectives. And I love the part you said about having an open heart and open mind to say, hey, you know what? I know that I focus stack every single flower picture I ever take, but let's try a lens baby. And can we get some of those lens baby people, Ann Belmont, and can we get them to try and do something where you've got that, you know, maybe it's focus stacking or really deep depth of field, whatever it is, to try something different and you're going to see the world in a different way. And that's kind of what I like about putting everyone all together in the same place and trying those things.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and I also get inspiration from all the people over 5,600 now in my group. When they post things, I look at their images through their eyes and through their lens. And for example, Donna Dobbs was just in our workshop in Asheville, and she employed a technique that was taught by Eileen, which is very similar to a technique that I teach, where you're doing multiples in the camera. And she applied it with a wide angle. And I'm always applying it in macro style. And when I looked at that image and I thought, oh, why not? You know, and so new doors are open as the you know, the synapses start to fire, and I see what other people are doing. It doesn't have to be a professional or somebody that's a speaker. We are all artists at heart, and we really inspire each other. And that's, you know, the beauty of being at a workshop is to see what other people are doing and not just have a one-way street. It's a lot of synergy there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've been all over the country photographing, and last year when I talked to you, you went all along the East Coast trying to find every garden, all the little secret gardens and everything. Maybe tell us about that, or tell us just about some of your favorite gardens that you've been to.
Well, what I did last year was I set off on a month-long road trip. I went 4,500 miles from St. Augustine up to Maine, and then back down, stopping in Boston. And I had a florographer named John Anderson, who was hoping to come and meet us along the way, because I set up a meeting in New York for any florographers who were within driving distance. And it was wonderful. I got together with maybe about 15 other photographers from the group, many of whom I had not met before. And so we got together at the New York Botanical Garden, and John said, boy, I'd like to come, but there's no way I can get over there from Ontario. And so I said, well, I'll tell you what, if I can pull a workshop together in a couple of weeks, I'll make it happen. I'll fly from Boston to Toronto and we'll do one there. And it worked out, and it was fabulous. So I met a bunch of wonderful people in Toronto, and then I had the opportunity to bring Don Kamarechka on board with me, because he lives in Barrie, Ontario, and that's his neck of the woods. And I just think it's the right thing to do when you're teaching in someone else's territory, to kind of bring them into your fold. So Don joined me, and we taught at the Toronto Botanical Garden, and it was a great collaboration of sorts. So it was all because of John's, you know, desire to get this going. And unfortunately, since then, John has passed away just a couple months ago.
Oh, wow.
But he was the catalyst in making that happen. So after we did that workshop, I flew back to Boston and continued my journey back down to St. Augustine. I went to over 20 gardens along the way, and certainly had my favorites. I had to say, I'd name a few. Chanticleer in Wayne, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Which is very near Longwood. We're actually not making it a part of it. They don't like having big, huge groups in there. But if you're coming to the Out of Longwood event, you might want to schedule a day before or after to get to Chanticleer. I want to say it's maybe 45 minutes from Longwood Gardens, something like that.
Yes.
45 an hour, maybe.
It's not
too far.
It's not too far in terms of miles, but because of
right.
the...
Right, it's all like back roads, yeah.
Uh-huh. The way things go in that area, yeah, it's a little bit of a drive, but it's close enough to make it there in a day. You just have to make sure that they're open on the days that you want to go, because I think they're closed on Tuesday, Wednesdays. I also loved Mount Cuba, and that same... Mount Cuba is actually closer to Longwood Gardens, and they're also closed on the same days as Chanticleer. So I would check both of those out. And those are in close proximity to Longwood. So if you're coming to the workshop, I would plan to go an extra 2 days on both ends, or one or the other end. And then the other garden that I loved was the Coastal Maine Botanical Garden up in Booth Bay. That was beautiful. Some of these gardens, though, like you mentioned, at Chanticleer, there's no lunch, no cafe, no classroom to use unless you're affiliated with them. So it makes a little bit of a challenge to have a workshop at places like that. I was checking gardens to see where I might host the next Florographers Unite, and Asheville really had the best combination of everything. So while the garden may not have been overly abundant with flowers, it had all of the, you know, boxes I could check: the hotel that was affordable and nearby, less than 2 miles away, a regional airport, and a nice large classroom, and food that could be brought in so that we didn't waste our time rushing out to eat and coming back. So that was what I was looking for, trying to accommodate people on the East Coast. Next year, I'm going to go either to the central U.S. or over to the West Coast.
Yeah, no, that's the best way to do it, is to keep moving around and get to see new places. And I mean, that's especially true when we do our landscape photography conferences, but to do that with the garden ones too, even though you're going to see some of the same flowers, it's different things, they're arranged different ways. And yeah, I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but also, like you said, to make it close for other parts of your group.
Yes, and there's things to do in different areas as well. So it's nice, even if you're seeing, you know, dahlias in Swan Island and dahlias at Longwood, you have a whole different environment around you that you can go play in after or before the conference.
Will you tell us about the Swan Island? This is outside Portland, is that right? Portland, Oregon. Yeah?
Yes. So that's in Canby,
Oregon. I've always wanted to go there. I'm sorry. So it's where?
Oh, it's in Canby, Oregon. It's beautiful. I used to grow dahlias. I lived in Alaska for 29 years. And for a good 20 of those, I had, oh gosh, I would say somewhere between 60 and 100 dahlias. And so every time the wind started to threaten, all the pots came in because I didn't have enough place, enough, you know, garden space to put them in the ground. So they came in the front door, the side door, the kitchen, the master bedroom, the garage, and just to keep them safe from blowing over in the wind and breaking stems. So I ordered bulbs for years from Swan Island, and I was able to go out and finally shoot in their farms. They've acres and acres of rows of dahlias that they're growing for export as tubers, but also to create some new varieties. And so Padma Ingava, who is from the New Jersey area, is going to join me out there, and we'll be teaching this September 3rd through the 7th at Swan Island. And we'll also incorporate a day at the Portland International Rose Garden. It's a test garden for roses, and the Japanese garden in Portland. And then we'll also be doing some editing.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's such a beautiful area. Last year when we went to Oregon to scout for our Oregon Coast Landscape Conference, we went to the Botanic Garden. We went to, the Japanese Garden. We went to the Rose Garden. But we were there in the spring. For the Swan Island, it has to be like September, October, August. Maybe? It's August?
I think from probably mid-August through mid-September, the dahlias from my growing days bloomed from... You know, they have the early bloomers, the mid-season bloomers, and the late bloomers. And so there's just this progression. So you kind of almost always throughout a 2-month period seem to have something in bloom. And what I love about dahlias is their height. You don't need to be laying down on the ground. So I have a lot of people in my groups who have physical limitations, and they can't just throw themselves on the ground and shoot those things really low in the forest or, you know, creeping along the dirt. So it's nice to have things that are much more accessible for people that, you know, can't necessarily get down low.
Yeah. And that was probably my favorite place at Longwood. And I know Ann Belmont, the same thing, is like the Dahlia Test Garden or whatever they call it at Longwood Garden. And that's all it is right there. And the time of year we're going to be going, it's going to be perfect to have that place going crazy. So I'm really looking forward to it.
She told me about that and really whet my appetite. So I'm very much very excited about that because we're going to be there at the perfect time for dahlias, I believe.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we went there last year at the exact same time. It was great. So yeah, really looking forward to doing Longwood Garden. When you were on your trip up the East Coast, you said you went all the way to Maine. Did you get to Acadia National Park and the gardens that are around there?
No, I only got to one garden. I went to pick up a girlfriend in Castine. She was up there for a miniatures conference. Her name is Fran Sussman. And so she joined me on the way back to Boston. But we didn't go to any of the other gardens up in Maine. We went to a small garden in Connecticut that was lovely. And we went to Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens down not too far out of Washington, D.C. We went to the U.S. National Botanical Garden. I'm not sure if I'm getting the whole name correct. It was very hot. That was my recollection. Once we got out of Maine, even in Maine at that time of year, it was unusually hot. And it was just a function of the way the season was last summer. It was hot and dry. And so that was evident in many of the gardens.
Yeah. So 2 years ago when we did Out of Acadia, we had Anne with us and we had Kathleen Clemens as one of our instructors. And we did like Thuya Gardens and Astiku Gardens, which are there just outside the park. And it was phenomenal to have the great landscape scenes, but then to get to go shoot those small scenes as well. So when you get a chance, you should go to Acadia. Actually, we're going to go there again next year. So maybe we should figure something out. But it's beautiful there.
Oh, I've seen photos of it, and it's mouthwatering. It's jaw-dropping beautiful. And I think Kathleen is from that area, so she knows all the places.
Exactly. Yeah. She lives right there. Yeah. Or not too far away. So, where do you find your inspiration? Do you maybe other photographers, in books? Where do you get your inspiration?
Well, I mentioned earlier that I'm very inspired by the people who are posting in my group. We had in the last 28 days, you can get statistics from Facebook, which I find fascinating. We had over 4,000 people who were active. That means we had 2,954 posts. That's over 100 per day in 28 days.
Wow.
We had, oh gosh, I want to say 22,000 comments and over 174,000 reactions in less than a month, which is shocking. And so all that activity, all those different images are filtering in from all over the world. And we've got people shooting all kinds of equipment and lenses and techniques. My inspiration is overflowing from there. But I also get inspired not just by looking at pictures of flowers. I'll just mention a few photographers that I find inspiring and really have helped shape me. One is Nancy Rutenberg, who's no longer alive. I was set up to take a workshop from her when I was living in Alaska, and unfortunately she passed away before the workshop actually came. And I was very much looking forward to learning from her because I looked at her work and it really spoke to me. It was just breathtaking. And when I wasn't able to study with her, I really then began analyzing what she did. And, you know, I would say that was probably a big turning point in my photographic journey, was to see two things. One was her style and use of backgrounds and how they complemented and really, you know, enhanced the subject. And that whole package was really what created the image. But more than that, I looked at who she was and what she did and how she touched so many people. And it really, it made me feel something inside that I never really felt before when I looked at other people's photographs, because I knew that she was a genuine person and she touched people in a very authentic way. And that spoke to me. So I would say she had probably the greatest influence on me. And then I also want to mention Clyde Butcher. Clyde is a black and white landscape photographer. He is everything that Ansel Adams was and more. And what I really love about Clyde is his dedication to conservation. And it's threaded into all that he does. He talks about how he could stay in Florida and photograph and photograph and photograph and still not find all the places, and how important it is for us to know our home. And while he's been invited to speak and exhibit all over the world, especially all over the United States, he's photographed certainly while he's there. And he has a beautiful book, America the Beautiful, that has photographs in black and white from every state within the country. But he also underscores the importance of photographers to really get to know their home. Shooting where you live and getting to know your home is so much more important than being on an eternal quest to shoot that iconic photo that you might have seen somewhere else, because you might learn and you might get that experience of standing where someone else was and shooting something, but what you can bring to the equation is to bring us where you live. And it doesn't have to be within a mile of where you live, but in your state, there's so much for all of us to go out and discover and then bring to the universe. And so I admire him for his staunch dedication to conservation, as well as the locations and the information and awareness that he brings to them. And also Guy Tall. Guy wrote a book called More Than a Rock, which I'm in the process of reading, and I just want to read it slowly. Each chapter is so profound and thought-provoking, and I agree with most of what he has to say, but I don't necessarily agree with every little shred of his philosophy. And that's what I love about him, is that he opens his mind and his thoughts to us and allows us to engage in a conversation and really tap into some deep thinking that we wouldn't necessarily do on our own, or that we do, but we don't put words to. And so I would say that if anyone bought any one book today about photography, I would buy that book called More Than a Rock by Rocky Nook.
Wow. Okay. And written by Guy Tall. Yeah. He's a really interesting guy. He's like the philosopher photographer, right? And his idea is that we can get so much more out of photography than just pictures, that it's the experience and that it's the way that it makes you see the world different and everything else that goes along with it. And I think there's so much we can do as photography instructors to help people get more out of their photography than just pictures. Yeah, and that's what he does.
Yes, I thoroughly agree. And when you see his imagery, it's beautiful, but it doesn't have the same effect until you read his words.
Oh, interesting.
I think that holds true in my group in photography. When people post beautiful photos, but then they share some behind the scenes with you about, for example, this was my mother's favorite flower. And I'm now growing 1,000 of them. Like Paul Johnson has planted all these daffodils in his yard. That means so much more. And I'm on the cover of a magazine in which I recently, it's actually on the stands this week. And Bill Hemmer, the publisher of Portfolio Magazine in Naples, did a 10-page spread on me, which was fabulous. But he wanted this one specific floral picture that I couldn't find right away. And he said he really wanted it because it was his mother's favorite and it was a pink dogwood. And when he showed me the article in draft, he didn't use that image. And I thought, well, maybe it didn't make the cut because it wasn't the right orientation or color. And then the surprise to me was that he used it on the cover. When I know things like that, it was your mother's favorite flower. That means so much more to me than just a pretty picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And not to make this salesy, but it's also like the same way that people buy photographs. You know, if you are working art fairs and things like that, we did a whole talk with Mike Motes and he says, you know, I sell these things and it's like, well, why did you buy that? And it's like, well, that was our wedding flower. Or that was, like you said, my mother's favorite flower or whatever it is, you know, that there's that connection. Whether you're going putting them in magazines or selling them at art fairs or whatever, that's more than just the picture, which is kind of what we were saying a minute ago with Guy Tall too. It's there's so much more to all of this than that final picture that people look at. There's so much. Actually, I love the term that we'll use it for our flower photography. I love the term that the street photographer Steve Simon uses, and he says that there is emotional metadata that goes along with images. And it's like all this other information behind it that you don't see it if all you see is the picture. There's so much more.
Absolutely.
To it. All right. So let's get, we got a little bit more time. We'll finish this up, but let's get a little bit technical. I want you to tell me about, you know, the secrets to your backgrounds. And I also want you to tell me what equipment you use. So which one do you want to start with? You get to choose.
Oh, okay. The equipment that I use pretty much Canon for almost everything. And I'm shooting with a Canon 5D Mark IV, which is full frame. And I've heard people say that equipment is important and other people say equipment is unimportant.
What's the right answer, Jackie Kramer? What's the right answer?
Well, I've seen great, great results come from all kinds of tools. And I think the answer lies in the user. I will say that there are certain nuances because I've had other cameras in my hands with different lenses. And certainly there's some effects that I can and cannot get from certain equipment. So I think that the real answer is you have to know what you're using and how to use it. And so if I'm shooting with a 7D, which has a crop factor, or one of the new mirrorless Micro Four Thirds, and you've got a 2x equivalent, you probably need to put a 60mm macro on if you're going to approximate what I see with a 100-105. Or I'm using a 180 now because I started out with a 70 and my 1.6 crop factor, which made my 100mm equivalent to 160mm. So when I grew up and I got a 5D Mark III and now a 5D Mark IV and I'm on full frame, my 100mm made things seem so far away. So I had to go buy a 180 if I wanted.
So I told people we were going to geek out. So do you have the Canon 180? Do you have the Tamron? I know a lot of people use that one, the old Tamron. What do you have?
I'm all Canon.
Canon. Oh, you said that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yep. So yep. The Canon 180, which is phenomenal for getting those blurred backgrounds, right? Is great for that.
Yes, I like the 100 and the 180. And I also, I don't think that floral photography has to be just macro. I think you can get some beautiful images, and I have with my Canon 24 to 70 millimeter, especially when I'm doing light painting or light pad work, and I'm maybe on a tripod, which I rarely use in the garden, but if I'm indoors, I'm almost always using a tripod, and I'll have my system set up, and I'll use in many cases the 24 to 70 or the 70 to 200, and those are both Canon lenses. What you can do with both of those are zoom, which you can't do with the fixed focal length 100 and 180. Also use on occasion the MPE 65 when you want high magnification. But that's another beast of its own.
It's really difficult to use. That's what Don Komarecki uses, right?
He uses that a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Don does extremely, magnified work, but he also uses the 100, and he also taps into quite a few vintage cameras and the Trio Plan and some of the Helios, which I also use the Helios, and I have several Lens Babies, and Lens Babies changes everything. I have both the fixed stationary Lens Babies, the Velvet 56 and 85, which give you a nice glow. And then I have the Lens Babies that tilt and kind of pivot around the base, the mount, the Sweet 35, the Sweet 50, and an edge. I mostly use the Sweet 35 and 50 for flowers and or the Velvets. And let's see, I also have the Sol 45, which has a fixed focal length of 3.5. And am I forgetting any? I'm borrowing their Twist right now just to kind of see what I can do with that. But I think that those are my primary lenses. My bag would have my Canon 100 and 180 in it if I'm going out to a garden, and at least two Lens Babies along with my body. And I take along an extension tube, macro converters, and close-up filters.
Wow. Yeah. So if I'm going to buy one Lens Baby, this is everyone's question, right? What's the one? What's the best one? What do I want to get?
Okay. Well, you have to choose between bending the light and getting a glow. If you want to bend the light, I suggest to people either the Sweet 35 or 50 with close-up filters or macro converters. If you want to get the glow, then I would probably recommend either the Velvet 56 or the 85. The 56 is going to give you much more of a glow, and you have to get used to that. And it's a wider focal length. The 85 is a little bit easier to use and is better and was designed for portrait work as well. So that will give you more reach in a garden. So I would say if you're going out in a garden, I would probably go with the 85. But I do like that kind of warpy, glowy feel that you get with the 56, almost wide open.
But I only get to pick one. What's the one?
Oh gosh. So with the Velvet 85.
Velvet 85.
Or the Sweet 35.
Mm. All right. We'll let you pick two. Fine.
And then lighting essentials. Can we touch on that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's very, very important. I think if you had one thing, one tool to put in your bag, it's a diffuser. Because if the sun gets too bright, and even if it's coming through the clouds and the clouds aren't providing enough diffusion to the light, you do need to have a diffuser. And I really like the 22 inch, because any bigger and the wind, even a slight breeze, will blow it out of your hand. Any smaller and you're not going to be able to diffuse the foliage around it. So that's my number one thing, is make sure you get a diffuser. They're not that expensive. And while we're on the subject of what to pack and what's in your bag or attached to your bag, I always bring a kneeling pad with me.
Yeah. Good advice. Yep. That's. Can't get really bad on your knees. Yeah. I usually just sit on my butt, but then it's hard to get to the positions you want to sometimes, right?
Oh, well, the kneeling pad is, that's why I use the kneeling pad.
Still for your butt. Okay.
Exactly. Cause I might lay down and I might put it under my shoulder or my butt. And this way I'm not just restricted to my knees. So if I have a kneeling pad, they usually have a handle, and I can use a gear tie to wrap through the handle and attach it to my bag, and then I'm hands-free.
Oh, nice. So that just hangs, and then you untie it, and And so you're saying that you would use that because if you were to use like knee pads or whatever, which a lot of people do too, then that's the only way you can go down is to go down on your knees. Yeah. All right. I like that. That's a good idea. I see a lot of people doing that and I'm like, I'm tough. I can handle this. And then I'm like, oh, but anything that's going to slow you down or stop you from getting pictures is going to, you know, inhibit your photography. So to have those pieces, you're like, okay, now I can stay down here for an extra 10, 15 minutes. So, I mean, don't think of it as essential, but it kind of is.
I have a kneeling pad. I have two of them, in fact, and I bought one at Terrain, which is a nursery right by Longwood. And they serve more than one purpose, because if you throw it on the ground and you want to change lenses and you're out in the garden where it's either rocky or muddy or dirty or wet, you put that down. And I always put the same side down. They're all double-sided. One side's gray. The other one is a color or a floral image. So I always put that side down so I know my other side's clean and I can put my lenses on it. So I can change out lenses or add filters on that surface that's clean and dry and flat.
Not while you're kneeling on it, but.
Correct.
Not right. Yeah. It's not that big. Yeah. No, I gotcha. That's great advice. You know, I just feel like I want to go shoot now. It's beautiful outside here too, by the way. Like, you've got me inspired, but I said that I would make sure you gave us your secrets for great backgrounds. Cause first off, like, how important is it to have a good background?
Okay. Well, I think it's very important. And I have a couple of workshops coming up that I'd like to talk about, because we're going to be doing a lot of that. I have two, and well, I'll start in chronological order. I have one in Victoria in June, and that'll be 5 days, 3 full days and 2 partial days. And we're going to be going to a variety of gardens. So that's full garden immersion as well as editing. And what I do with that small group of 15 or less is really look for backgrounds and teach people how to find them. They're everywhere. They're on trees and they're the wrought iron. It's I love Victoria because there's just a plethora of backgrounds everywhere, color blurs. And then I'm going to also be teaching that in Seattle and in Alaska, where we're doing 3 days. I'm bringing in Andrea Gulix from the Netherlands and Don Komarechka, as we mentioned before, from Barrie, Ontario.
Mm-hmm. And he will be out of Longwood also, so you're going to be seeing him a lot.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. I'm very excited. Don brings a lot of energy and joie de vivre to the photography world. Andrea does a lot with ethereal work, and so I bring the editing. And so the three of us have very different techniques and styles from three different countries, all in one place under one roof. So people will get to spend 1 day with each of us. And so we'll do backgrounds, and Andrea will do what she does, which is more heavily weighted towards in camera, and Don more towards his water refractions and his magnified work indoors. So I'll be focused on those backgrounds and finding them and editing with them in Seattle in July, and then in Anchorage, July, immediately following that. So it's the 13th to the 15th in Seattle, Bellevue to be specific, and then 18th to the 20th in Anchorage, Alaska. And then in August, I'll be with you at out of Longwood with you.
That's and awesome. All.
Yes, you've got some great instructors, and so I'm very much looking forward to meeting them and hearing them present. So that's in August 19th through the 23rd out of Longwood, and then September 3rd through the 7th, as we talked about earlier, at Swan Island, doing dahlias and roses in Portland. And then that's my year in a nutshell. I've got a few appearances.
You're living the dream, aren't you?
Well, I've dreamt about this for many, many, many years while I worked as an engineer.
Yeah. Wow. So, that's a whole other conversation, is you must bring your technical abilities and combine that with the creative. And that's why you get such amazing images. Yeah. And the great teaching. So, yeah, we'll talk about that when we get together. But you still haven't given us, if people cannot join us in Longwood or on one of those workshops, what are your secrets? Tell us your secrets of the backgrounds. What do you have to do to get a great background in your shot?
Oh, in the shot, if you want a great background, the number one thing is to look for it, and look for separation between your subject and the background you're shooting. So you want to make sure that your flower isn't encroached by other leaves and flowers. So look for things that are merging and interfering with your subject, whether it's one flower or multiple flowers. You want to make sure that there aren't things like sticks or weeds or other flowers or found objects, signs or posts or late plant labels, you want to make sure that if it doesn't enhance an image, that it's not in it. And if you can't move your vantage point either lower or higher or in one direction or another to eliminate that, then you have to ask yourself the question, is this something that I can eliminate in post-processing? In some cases it is. In some cases it's going to be a nightmare. So maybe that's, you know, if you're at a garden, maybe that's just a shot you might want to take and say, I may or may not be able to work with this, but keep going. Don't waste too much time there. So I definitely think that when we go to a place like Longwood, there are so many opportunities. So you look for the best possible arrangement, the distance between you and your subject and the distance from the subject to the background. And you ask yourself the question, is this going to work? Try it out. Look at your screen, evaluate the image, and really look for bright spots, dark spots, signs, people walking by, other flowers, distracting. And if there's too many distracting elements in the wrong places and you can't remove them, then either find a different vantage point or move on, or take it and see if you can deal with it later. And if you don't have the skill set to address it now, maybe you will later.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to be with a good flower photographer, and they'll be looking at a group of flowers and it's like, well, why did you pick that one to photograph? Because that's not the best looking flower necessarily. And they go, but yeah, but look at how amazing the background is. So using that as part of the selection of what flower to photograph too, I sometimes see them and it's like, that would be awesome to photograph, but there's no way I'm going to be able to get a decent background out of it. So I think that was an interesting thing that I picked up along the way, is that you select the flowers based on what that background's going to look like too, because like you said, you might not be able to make it work.
Right. And I, you know, since I've taught now in a variety of situations, I've noticed that some people will come to a workshop and say, well, what are your settings? And I have the same full frame, I have the same 100mm, and I have the same settings, and I can't get what you're getting. And then I look at their camera and I discover that they actually don't have the same lens. They have an old film lens sometimes, and everything's different on it. So what they're getting isn't necessarily what I'm getting. And so a lot of it is going to depend on the equipment that you're using, which goes back to knowing your gear and what it's capable of. And the number one thing that I tell people, if you're going to come to my workshop and you don't have a macro lens, yes, I will be teaching some things where you don't necessarily need a macro lens, but when we get out in the field, if you don't have one, you're going to always wish that your picture looked different and wonder why it didn't. And so I always encourage people that if you can't afford it or you're not sure you're going to do it, rent one. They're not that expensive to rent a macro lens. And people who do have a whole new world open up to them.
Yeah. That's especially true with people like me that shoot a lot of landscapes and shoot the architecture. You put a macro lens and something like that in their hand and just, they start looking at the world in a totally different way. They're like, wow, I'm just looking for small things now, which is, it just, that's when you start to get creative instead of seeing it the same way you always did. So I just wanted to add on to the other thing too. We have so many people come to our events and they work with a professional like you, and they say exactly what you said. They're like, I've got the same things. Like, how come I can't get this to work? And then they'll try and photograph a flower, and they're like, well, how would you do this? You're a pro. You should be able to get a great shot. And a lot of times the answer is, no, I couldn't do it with that flower. It's got a terrible background, and there's no position you can get yourself in to give it a good background. They go, well, no. You're a professional. You should be able to make it work. It's like, no, you know how I do it? I go to a different flower, you know, and that's the answer. That's what the professional does. They put themselves in the right spot. They pick the right subject, and then they can get the shot. It's not that you can take anything and turn it into a great picture. It's that you know how to find the right things to photograph too.
Well, absolutely. If I go into a clothing store and say I walk into Nordstrom's, all the clothes are beautiful, but not all of them are going to look good on me.
Hmm.
So I have to know. You have to have some experience to make the right decisions and choices. And it doesn't all come at once. And I think that's another thing that I really want to express to people is don't feel it has to be rushed, because you miss out if you get the perfect pictures the first day of a workshop or the last day of a workshop, you've missed that whole era of learning. I've been shooting since I was 16, and I started on film, and I've made all kinds of mistakes. And sometimes I went making mistakes for years and years. And I didn't know. And I didn't even have a macro lens until my husband gifted me one in 2010. And that's when things really changed for me, because I shot a lot of flowers and birds, but I had film in the old days. And then I took a little bit of a hiatus between that and digital. And I really like to stay one thing at a time, one step at a time. It's a journey. And that's the best part of it. It's not the destination. It's being in the garden. It's experiencing it. It's learning new things. And you don't have to learn it all at once in one workshop. That's why people go back to workshops year after year after year, because you can't assimilate everything all at once. It's just, if you do, I think you're just sort of shortchanging yourself.
Yeah. And that's like back to the Guy Tall thing, like you were just saying, it's more than just the final product that you're making, and it's about the experience. And that's why we love what we do and helping people and all this. So we hope to see lots of you guys. I think for Longwood, we have one or two spots left, I think, for yours. I think people can sign up for those. Like, where do people go to find out more information about your workshops and to see your photographs, Jackie?
Well, you can go to my website. It's called lovebblooms.com. That's my website for flowers. I have another one, Jackie Kramer Photography for Weddings and such. But so it's a little bit confusing. So if people Google me, they're probably not going to go to my flowers first. But it's just a function of having to separate my flowers out away from my people. So my website is called Love Blooms, and it's spelled LUVBLOOMS.com. And then there's a tab for workshops, and you can see all my workshops. I'll be speaking this Thursday at B&H. Canon is sponsoring me to go up to New York, so I'll be there talking about establishing a solid foundation with the macro lenses, the 100 and the 180 primarily. And then I'll be doing a walkabout hosted by B&H, and that's free for everybody who's interested, from 8:30 to 10 in the morning at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. We're going to be meeting at the entrance at 8:30 in the morning, 8:30 to 10.
Did you say that's this Thursday?
So the talk is Thursday at noon.
Okay.
Thursday, May the 16th. And then
this is probably going to come out on Thursday is why I'm saying it. But
okay.
When is the walk?
And the walkabout is Friday, May 17th at 8:30, right, Brooklyn Botanic Gardens. And those are both free events, but you must register on the BNH website to be included in those. And then I will be doing an infield session at 10:30. For anyone who is interested in staying and bringing your own camera. So the walkabout will be me demonstrating maybe some shoot throughs, walking through and demonstrating and explaining why I might pick a certain flower or set of flowers rather than others, showing maybe some abstracts, multiples, shooting textures. And then for those folks who are interested in staying with me for my workshop, and registration is on my website, that will commence at 10:30 there and will continue through the day, and you'll be shooting and I'll be guiding you and showing you how to get a small depth of field and how to make a blurry background and how to shoot textures or multiples or whatever it is that you want to learn. And then all the rest of my workshops are there on the Love Blooms website.
You know, the best part about all of this is, I just feel like we could talk about this all day. We keep going, you know, the philosophies and the techniques. And I just love the way that it's the technical and the creative and the philosophical, like all put together. That's what makes this so wonderful. But it's the conversations that we're having here that make this so much fun. And that's what you get to do. I mean, you can kind of do it in your Facebook group, like you talked about, but to sit down with somebody one-on-one, to have lunch, to have dinner with them, on one of your workshops or one of our events, you know, that's what really makes it special. So I can't wait to hang out with you, ask you more questions. And I know other people have lots of questions and will have great conversations as well. So
you're absolutely right. Anybody can go to a garden and shoot by themselves, but you can't conjure up a group. If you go with a group, you can always walk away on your own and have a little, you know, quiet Zen session in the garden and then rejoin the group. But there's so much synergy that you get from being in an environment like this, where people are, you know, just that, you know, firing off ideas, and you get to see the results of some of this, that you can't replicate that yourself.
Right. Yeah. And we, Oh, we're way over time here, I think, but that's okay. That's okay. But yeah, that was one of the things we were going to talk about is, you know, a lot of people feel they're only going to get their good shots when they're on their own. But when you're with a group, the synergy, I like the way you say that. And you know, you go check out the back of someone else's camera, like, whoa, I didn't even think about that. And you don't necessarily go shoot the exact same subject, but to shoot it in that way, now you're creating something new again that you wouldn't have thought to do if you were all there by yourself. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Jackie. So if you want to see her work, it's at lovblooms, LUVblooms.com. And yeah, Jackie's going to be with us at Out of Longwood this August. It's going to be super awesome. So thank you, Jackie. Thanks for teaching us so much. And I can't wait to hang out with you.
Thank you. Likewise, Chris. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
All right. Talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.